Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, April 18th, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host. Last Saturday, Lyndon LaRouche delivered a sharp and necessary lesson in statecraft and economics to President Barack Obama. In the first part of his webcast, he did exactly what he said he would do. He took the president out to the proverbial woodshed, reading him the riot act, so to speak. From the initial reports we have received from relevant circles, it is clear that while the president didn't like it much, and some people were a little shocked and frightened by what LaRouche did, at least some of those who heard the webcast were happy about what Lyndon LaRouche did. The main focus of his opening comments was to identify the gang of kooks who are setting the agenda for the president. This is a strange gaggle of so-called behavioral economists who have the president singing their tune. Today on our program, we will examine who they are and why it is perfectly legitimate to say that they are not economists, but that they are kooks, they are corrupt, and the economic theories they espouse have been thoroughly discredited by the deepening economic collapse, which has been caused by the implementation of their free market quackery over the last 40 years. Oh, and by the way, they are also supporters of fascist economic policies. If President Obama does not break with them, not only will he be discredited, with his presidency in a shambles, but our nation will cease to exist as a constitutional republic. Joining me on today's program to discuss this will be John Hoeffel, the banking editor for Executive Intelligence Review, and someone who is not a kook and who does know something about economics. We'll also be joined by LaRouche Youth Movement members Alicia Cerdatani from the LaRouche Pack TV, who's been involved in the posting of some of the videos that you can see on LaRouchePack.com website on this question of the kook economics, and also Paul Marino, who's been very active in fighting for LaRouche's Homeowner and Bank Protection Act, will be with us briefly from Houston. So John, let's start with the obvious question. What is a behavioral economist?
You mean besides a fascist idiot?
A fascist idiot kook. Let's go from there.
Okay. The behavioral economist, and of course, every time you say this thing, it has to be in quotes, even if you don't say the quotes. It's got to be in quotes because there is no economics about this at all. What this group of people are is these are British-trained Psywar specialist whose job it is to prepare the American people for the austerity that's coming at us hard and fast and is going to only get worse, that as we get the combination of things that are coming, as we get the bill for the bailout, we have to have less government, less services, higher taxes and all of that. And as we push with this green agenda and we have to give up our consumption and start to live simpler, less consuming lives, all of which is just the happy face you paint on a policy of fascist austerity as we end the bubble and head into the collapse of the nation state.
It doesn't sound like much of a happy face, John.
Well, you know, the British version of a happy face might be somewhat different than what we might consider the happy face.
Well, let's just take a look at a couple of aspects of what they say, because from what I can gather from the reports we filed, and you've put a number of these up on the LaRouchePack.com, but from what I can tell, what they say they believe and what they actually believe are two different things. Do they really think that markets are efficient but people are not? Is that part of their belief?
I don't think so. I think they're frauds from the beginning. I don't think they actually believe any of this. I think that this is marketing, that their job is to paint prepare us for the collapse and to go, you know, as the British are fond of saying, Aldous Huxley said it, that you have the best prisons are the prisons of your mind. And they're trying to come up with ways to make us believe that all of these bad things that are happening to us are something that are good. They paint it in a positive way. It's sort of like when you when you go to the store, you go to buy a box of tube of toothpaste, and you get a package which says new and improved, and you open up the package, and you got 2 ounces less toothpaste in it.
Well, so one of the things that Lynn said is that this is social engineering, because even though they're engaged in this kind of spin, you might say, or brainwashing, they actually are trying to condition the population to get used to living with less.
Yeah. I mean, I think spin and brainwashing, and I think they're just flat lying. I mean, if you take a look at one of the gurus of this, is a guy named Richard Thaler, who is the co-author of a book called Nudge. And he has an article in the latest Newsweek called It Doesn't Have to Hurt. Now, you know, if you think about what the implications of that, you know, it's coming. It could very well hurt you. But if you decide you like it, it doesn't really have to hurt.
If you decide there's a greater good and you're starving to death.
Well, yeah, sure, you know. Or bend over and take it like a peasant.
Well, now, John, one of the aspects further of this grouping is it's very much connected to the green technology. And in that sense, LaRouche has identified both the eugenicist ideas behind it and also the radical population reduction. To what extent are these guys open in their espousal of that?
Well, they're fairly open about it, but they tend to try to paint all of these things in the positive way. So we're going to, you know, it's sort of the small is beautiful. We're going to have to live with less. But their particular take on this is that these are behavior changes, that you just have to shift the way you think about things, and then you come to realize that you've been consuming too much, and we have to save the planet, and so therefore, you just have to cut back.
John, you and I had talked earlier this week about an article in the Financial Times that spoke about the consumer anthropologists and cultural anthropologists who are doing studies, and they said that the U.S. consumers are shifting towards conscientious consumption and thriftiness and moving away from aspirational luxury shopping. Now, if you listen to the language itself, you can tell there's an academic brainwashing quality to it. But the argument that Americans are now choosing to be more thrifty, I don't know that there's that much choice involved. I think people who lose jobs or losing their homes can't get credit. I don't know that that's actually a lifestyle choice.
No, it's not. I mean, it's austerity. People are having to live on less. And that's the name of the game with all these behaviorists and the cultural anthropologists. What a ridiculous term. That, you know, the people, it's like Thaler said in his article in Newsweek, that if you're broke, the problem is you don't save enough. You know, you're completely throwing out the fact that the global financial system has died and that we're all living on the downside of the biggest financial bubble in history. And, you know, we're basically careening into a new dark age unless we change our policies. And their response to this is it's an attitude problem on our part.
You're listening to John Hofel. This is the LaRouche Show. It's April 18th, 2009. We're reviewing the crazy brand of new economists who are really the old fascists, maybe with a new label. And John, I'd like to go back to a couple things Mr. LaRouche said on the webcast last Saturday, because he was very clear on this. He said that President Obama has been captured by this group and is pursuing their policies. What does that mean in terms of where the administration is going?
Well, the administration, having initially seemingly stood up to the Brits and snubbed Gordon Brown when he arrived in Washington, then when Obama went to the G20 meeting, you know, basically he met with the Queen. He, you know, he genuflected. He liked the glory, and he signed off on this IMF policy of turning the IMF into a global financial dictator.
And you mentioned that Gordon Brown wants that policy. Who else wants the International Monetary Fund as the new global central bank?
Well, that's the British plan. That's the British plan. And there's a shift in Britain underway, it would appear, in which the the Labour Party is out and the Tory Party is coming in. And, you know, but they're pushing this, and they're also pushing this behavioral policy, but there's a real irony in that, because the behavioral economics, so-called, was actually developed in Britain. It comes from the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations and the London School of Economics, and they develop these programs, they feed them into the United States, and then they bring them back into Britain as if they're American policies, when in fact this is what the Brits do all along, and they use Britain as a test tube for all of the social engineering. You know, you can see this in the way in which they're turning it into the surveillance society over there, which is, you know, basically they're turning the island into Jeremy Bentham's panopticon.
Well, this sounds a lot like what we identified in the mid-1970s as, actually, we didn't identify it. They called it fascism with a human face, which was a combination of Tavistock, the Rockefeller Foundation, and others who were trying to establish, at that time, a global fascist regime. Is that along the same lines? Is it the same gang of people?
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, they changed the marketing strategy a little bit, because they're aiming now at the younger generation. And they're pushing the idea that the older generation has blown it, the boomers have blown it, you know, they've destroyed the world, and therefore you guys are going to have to, you younger people are going to have to come in and clean this up. We're going to have to change our ways. We're going to have to do with less. But it's a conscientious decision to market this to the youth generations so that that people will, you know, adopt this early on, and then as they grow up, then this will become the dominant policy, and that's their hope. But even this is really a fraud, because the real issue here that underlies all of this brainwashing and manipulation is that the global financial system has died, that nothing that's being done right now, from the bailouts through this behavioral engineering, this psy war, is actually an economic policy. It's all political, because the fight is not to save this existing system. The fight is over what kind of a system replaces it.
Well, John, that brings me to the role of Larry Summers. And let me give out our email address. If people have a question they'd like to email in for John or the other panelists, it's radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And we're discussing the follow-up to the dynamic webcast given by Lyndon LaRouche last Saturday, which is available. It's archived both in transcript, written transcript, and also video form on LaRouchePack.com. Now, we're talking about Larry Summers, and I think he sort of brings us to the real core of this thing, because I'd like you to go through his role with the behavioral economist, but I'd also like to preface that by saying that it's clear that in addition to being an incompetent economist, Summers is a thief, he's corrupt, and his thumbprints are all over the destruction of the last bit of regulation in the 1990s, the getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Bill. So he is witting in his commitment to these policies, is he not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that if you look at his track record, as you say, he's a completely incompetent economist. Everywhere his policies have been put into effect, they've resulted in disaster. I mean, one of the best examples is in Lithuania, when Lithuania was breaking from the Soviet Union, and they brought in Summers to help them with their economic policy. Within 2 years, their suicide rate had doubled. You know, people were literally killing themselves to get away from Larry Summers' policies, and the whole country said, forget this, and went back to communism. You know, that's how effective Larry Summers' policies have been. But that's basically by design, because what he is an agent of the British Empire. And his role is to destroy nation states. And now he's, you know, working in the White House. He's Obama's chief economic advisor. And he's doing two things. The one thing he's the champion of this bailout. He's making sure that we kept trillions of dollars continuing to flow into Wall Street and into the hands of this imperial financial oligarchy.
John, let me just ask you, when people like Summers and Geithner and others are pushing this bailout, you had said earlier it's really about what system replaces this one. Do they think they can keep this system going much longer, or is this an interim strategy?
I think it's an interim strategy. I think they want to save the derivatives markets, and you know, this is what the British call their invisibles, the earnings from finance and things like that. They want to save this method of looting because it's highly efficient. But they want to, and they want to just grab as much money as they can. They want to bankrupt the nation states.
So they're not partial to, for example, Citibank. They'd be more than happy to let Citibank go at any point.
Well, I think that the idea is that you're going to let some of these giant banks go, that you basically suck all the wealth out of them that you can, anything that you think is a good asset, and then you leave them, you leave this rotted out hulk, this bankrupt hulk, and you dump it on the nation, and then you demand that the nation bail it out. And this is what gives it bankrupts the nation. And the end result of this, from their fantasy anyway, is that the nation states will all be destroyed, and that will leave the empire free to rule over whatever pile of rubble is left.
A big part of what Lyndon LaRouche discussed last Saturday was the way that Summers and others are controlling Obama and, in fact, setting him up for failure. It seemed very clear to me from watching his speech on Tuesday, where, as he was talking about the green shoots of recovery, which Bernanke had talked about a couple days earlier. Everyone's looking at the figures. It's almost like they're seeing the downward curve and they're standing on their heads and thinking it's up. But as Obama was giving the speech about a recovery and consumer confidence growing, it was at that same day that the new figures came out on consumer spending and showed a 1.1% drop in retail sales, the highest month ever in new foreclosure filings in March. So, I mean, obviously they're not serving him very well. Where do you see this heading, John? I mean, the president continues to seem to be under the influence of this brainwashing of Summers.
He is, and where this is heading is we're headed for a complete breakdown of not only our economy, but of our society and our culture. I mean, we're in a breakdown crisis that's across the board. And this, all of the policies that are in place now, from the bailout to the idea of trying to restore these financial markets, which is insane, to the behaviorist economics, all of this, none of this is solving anything. All of this is continually weakening the country. We're not doing anything to address this real problem.
And I guess we saw one more example of the corruption of this crowd in the last few days with the reports on Felix Rowett and protege Stephen Ratner, the so-called car czar designee. Turns out he's under investigation for giving bribes in New York State. So the corruption follows them around.
Who would guess that a bunch of crooks would turn out to be corrupt?
Well, John, stand by because we'll come back to you in a minute. I want to bring in Paul Marino. Paul is very active. In fact, he can't sit still very long, so we're lucky to have him for just a couple of minutes. Paul has been one of the members of the LaRouche Youth Movement who's been spearheading the drive to get a real solution implemented, LaRouche's Homeowner and Bank Protection Act. Paul, we've had some fairly significant breakthroughs in Texas in the last few days. Why don't you give us a quick report on what's happened?
Well, for the past couple of months, we've had groups of students driving from Brownsville on the coast there, which is the furthest south you can go in Texas before getting to Mexico, and then going north along the Rio Grande up until Laredo, visiting all the city governments, to brief them on the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, take them through the policy solution to the collapse in the housing and the banking crisis, and of course asking them to step up to the plate and fight with LaRouche's ideas and LaRouche's policies. And you know, many of them see this as necessary for their survival, because the economic conditions in all of these cities along the valley is extremely desperate. It's a rural setting where water has become scarce, and so many of the farms, it was once a very productive farming sector. In the last decade or so, that has been increasingly shut down, and they've had not enough water to go around. And so we saw this manifest in many of the city halls as we went from one to the next. there were people lining up trying to figure out how they were going to pay their water bill, whether it was for personal consumption or for farming. And bear in mind, many of these families have already lost their home and have consolidated, where the extended family has all moved into one major dwelling. So they're in tough times down there, but you can see that a growing number of them are ready to fight with in terms of bringing up LaRouche's Homeowners and Bank Protection Act.
Paul, when you say bringing it up, what exactly have you done in these cities? What is it we're asking you to do?
Well, we're asking them to put it on the record and pass the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act as a memorializing resolution to the U.S. Congress and the President, asking them to act in the prescribed manner to deal with the banking and the housing crisis. So obviously by law, none of these city governments has the legal authority to change monetary and financial policy, but nonetheless, they're still part of the executive and the legislative branches of government. And so they're passing a resolution expressing their intent and their knowledge on economics and policy.
And Paul, we've had some supporters who have jumped in and participated in moving some of these city councils. I know we have a lot of listeners on today who would like to do this. Why don't you just give a sense of what you have to get across to these councilmen so they actually take it up and move with it?
Well, they first have to get an idea of what the legislation does and what it is legally. That is a memorializing resolution to the U.S. Congress asking them to act in the prescribed manner. That is to put a freeze on the housing crisis and to reorganize the banking system. Now, for supporters who want to take this up and get it addressed, there's normally one or two ways you can do that. One, you can just show up at the public comment section during the next City Hall meeting, or you can go and do some homework, find the number of the city secretary, the city manager, or the mayor, and sit down and meet with them and discuss the policy through with them. And what you'll tend to find is that they are a little more honest than the average person. You know, they'll tend to agree because most people are against the bailouts. And then it just becomes a question of how they're going to proceed or when they're going to proceed.
Well, I would recommend that people go on to the website where it references the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act. And Paul, one of the things that John and I were discussing, John is an old Texan, as you probably know, or at least he spent a lot of time here. And John had a particular interest in the area that you've been working recently, that area of South Texas. What are some of the towns that have passed it?
Well, coming south from Laredo, you have one of the more recent ones was Roma, Texas, which is the first major town you come to after you leave Laredo. There's a very large gap where there's just ranches and nothing between Laredo and Roma. That's all in Starr County. And then going east, some of the major cities would be La Jolla, which is known in the valley as having the best educational system. And incidentally, they did pass the LaRouche PAC, the exact HPPBA as we wrote it, so maybe that has something to do with their education system. Going further east, you have Edinburgh and McAllen, which have not acted yet, but we're in discussion with them. They're larger. Next to Edinburgh is Farr, which is a fairly large city in that area, and they passed the HPPA. And then going further east yet, you have a whole bunch of smaller towns like Elsa, Santa Rosa, San Benito, and so on.
Didn't Brownsville and Cameron County also pass it?
Oh, yes. Brownsville will be the furthest east you can go, and that's the largest city in the valley there. They were one of the first to act. That might have been almost a year and a half ago. And at the time, we also were able to get a hold of a number of the county commissioners. And the county commission in Cameron County passed the same legislation as well.
Well, Paul, I know you've got other things to do. I'd like to thank you for coming on. And, of course, John wants to know if you've had any interference from the King Ranch.
Well, probably, but nothing that I've seen directly, you know, because their influence and policies, I'm sure, is wide, and they're probably harassing some of the folks that we've spoken to. directly or indirectly. But we'll run to that more so as the months unfold. We have a crew that has just passed through the San Patricio area, which is to the north of the King Ranch. And incidentally, that's a whole other geographic and political block. I mean, there's a whole interesting history here to the Texas Revolution and the Mexican-American War that the King Ranch, I'm sure, played a nefarious part in.
Well, one thing you should watch out for is if any of your HBPA supporters start getting invited to go out to the Armstrong Ranch or the King Ranch and go hunting with Dick Cheney.
Yes, that's right. That's right. They might get shot in the face.
Yeah, okay, well, Paul, thanks a lot. And I think anybody who just got this little report from Paul has a sense that this is a potential for tremendous expansion, because the crisis, as we've been talking about in this program, is deepening. We could go through the foreclosure figures, but since the HBPA was written in the end of July, early August 2007, after LaRouche's famous July 25th, 2007 webcast, when he announced that the financial system had collapsed, since it was written, there have been close to 1.5 million homes forcibly repossessed. There are another over 1 million to 1.5 million currently in some form of foreclosure. In February, there were 88,000 new repossessions, and this is going to increase. So, and also, if you look on the various reports, now that the moratoria on foreclosures that the banks were issuing has ended, we're going to see another spike upward, including Alt A and the prime rate mortgage loans. So get on the website, get the HPPA moving, and if you need some help with that, you can go to the LaRouche PAC website and communicate with people there, or you can call your local LaRouche representative. So, Paul, thanks a lot for the report.
You're welcome. If I could just say one other thing in closing, Harley.
Sure.
A part of an inspiration for the work that this work has been designed to do, perhaps in the long term, is to bring out a new quality of leadership in the population. And that is, we don't have real qualified leaders at any place, really, in the national government. And so our hope is that through work like this over a longer period of time, we'll be able to develop qualified candidates for office who will have a lot more competence than what you see heretofore in the Congress.
Okay, very good.
So,
what LaRouche calls your local constituency leaders.
There you go.
All right, Paul, thanks a lot. John, before I bring in Alicia, do you have any comments on the process around the HBPA and the foreclosure crisis?
Well, obviously the foreclosure crisis is getting worse. The banking crisis is getting worse, despite the ridiculous claims both that the banks are making profits and that some of these banks are healthy enough to give the TARP money back. You know, take, for example, Goldman Sachs, which says that it's going to give this money back because it doesn't really need it, except that Goldman Sachs is, in addition to the $10 billion it got from the TARP, it's also got $28 billion in FDIC-guaranteed loans, and these things are still able to function only because the federal government is throwing in trillions of dollars. So the idea that they somehow don't need this money is just ridiculous. You know, the whole thing, they're just lying, frankly. They're just lying that the books are being cooked on a massive scale. And this whole thing is continuing to slide deeper and deeper into bankruptcy every day.
All right, now we have with us also Alicia Ceritani, who is one of the people in the LaRouche PAC TV editorial. Alicia has done some of these programs. Give us a sense, Alicia, of what is up on the website now and also what's coming up, because we have to get more of you out there going every day, because we're putting out new material every day. Go on the website, get your friends to look at it. So, Alicia, why don't you give us a little bit of a report?
All right. Well, we've obviously have had plenty of material to cover, given LaRouche's expertise on forecasting the whole thing. But now the task is to educate the population and create sort of a unified effect, a unified mission to save the country, save the unique capability of the United States to bring other countries into a real recovery. And so the the key fight is to demonstrate that, as John Hopeful often makes the point, this is a bunch of British fascists surrounding the president. And their credibility, they don't really have much of a credibility. So what we've tried to do is demonstrate how and why you have the president-elect, the president today, fall victim to a bunch of people who have no interest in a recovery for the United States. And what LaRouche has made very clear is that he's absolutely obsessed with himself. He's largely part of a systemic and generational problem of indifference, where his interests aren't necessarily in saving the country he was elected to lead. And he's more interested in looking good and being popular and being copacetic. But that's not how you win a war. That's not how you change the very behavior of institutions and academia and professionals that got us into this mess. You don't change them by adapting to it. So what we've been trying to make clear to the population is the underlying assumptions of a monetarist system, and that oftentimes is married with just the outlook of leaders, what they're actually trying to accomplish. So the only credibility of these people around Obama, this behaviorist pack of things, is that Obama's really at this point just too busy looking in the mirror to have looked at their rap sheets. Basically, they don't have a credibility. They only can exist in D.C. at this point because you have a president who's looking the other way.
And Alicia, I think you were involved in a couple of the videos we put up on the Nero complex. What exactly does LaRouche mean when he says President Obama is afflicted by narcissism? And you've touched on it, but how does this work?
Well, LaRouche has made the point that the United States could very well be in the same position that Rome was in, is that Obama, taking the advice of his advisors, they have the audacity to advise the man. He surrounded himself when he was first elected by some very competent people, some people that had been around the institution of the presidency for many years, and who actually had an idea of how to handle this thing with the help of Mr. LaRouche. But Obama was actually offended and threatened by that competence because it challenged his own. And so you have this sort of emperor phenomenon where he doesn't want to be proved wrong necessarily, although he has no idea what he's doing. So it's almost like he thinks he was elected as the emperor, and his will be dictated through his advisors, versus the reality of the situation is that you have an institution of the presidency, you have varying levels of competence and experience that lead the country. And his ego was bruised when he was schooled by this group of more competent, seasoned veterans of the presidency. His ego was bruised, and he actually fled from them and came into this pack of wolves who obviously aren't going to challenge him because they're interested in seeing this bailout through and going through this fascist austerity. So it's a real big problem that he's not allowing himself to be advised and to be shown and criticized and really educated by people who know better than him.
Well, and that was the effect or the attempt, the effort made by Lyndon LaRouche last Saturday. And again, that webcast is available for people on the LaRouchePact.com. That was what Lyndon LaRouche was trying to do, was to say to Obama, look, here's reality. Now, John, it seems to be the case that what we're dealing with now, besides Larry Summers and a Harvard grouping, that the actual impetus for these policies does come from this nest of fascists at the University of Chicago. Why don't you give us a little bit of background on this?
Well, the University of Chicago, the home of the Mont Pelerin Society and Milton Friedman, the man who pushed the idea of free trade and drugs, opium and things like that, that these guys are pushing austerity, that one of the Obama, the guy who was his chief advisor, economic advisor during his campaign is a guy named Austin Goolsbee from the University of Chicago, who was pushing, has pushed in the past and continues to push this idea of the incentive model for labor, you know, which I think if people have ever seen how sweatshops operate, now people are paid on piecemeal, where you have to produce more and more faster and faster in order to make it, you know, even approach a living wage, that's what they have planned for the whole labor force of the United States. And that then you have these others, these behaviorists who come out of the University of Chicago and out of places like that. The, you know, Larry Summers' uncle, Kenneth Arrow, who's one of the, he has two uncles who won Nobel Prizes, Kenneth Arrow and Paul Samuelson. And Kenneth Arrow is a big proponent of Bertrand Russell and his game theory and econometrics, and one of the people who laid the, if I hate to use the phrase, the intellectual framework for the derivatives market, which is all blown up. And Larry Summers has spent much of his time working for hedge funds and helping to design some of these models. So, you know, you have this British fascist crowd, because the University of Chicago started, I think, was at the British school in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Straight British pedigree.
It was deployed against McKinley's tariff policy in the 1896 presidential campaign. That's when the Chicago School Economics Department actually was taken over by the Rockefeller family.
So they have a proud tradition of treason against the United States, which is continues to this day. And so you have, but you have sort of a two-tier policy in the administration. The one tier is the push for the bailout. More and more money gets funneled into the bankers and into the things like Goldman Sachs, but into the arms of this financier oligarchy, while the people who are going to have to pay the bill get the benefit of the second tier, which is this behavioral modification, you know, to get people ready to pay, start paying the bills and to start collapsing. And, you know, so this is all atrocious on its face. This is just nasty, evil stuff on its face. But it gets even worse from that, because this is not where it's not going to stop there. We're headed into something much, much worse.
Alicia, you had mentioned in what you said earlier, and by the way, let me just remind you again, if you want to get an email question in, we can still take it. It's at radio@larouchepub.com, radio@larouchepub.com. Alicia, you mentioned this concept of indifference, a generation of people who are passive and indifferent. How does that work with the youth generation? And, of course, we've identified MySpace, Facebook, Twitter, the whole thing. But how does that work? Why is it that people go along with these so-called theories?
Well, there's sort of a element and an unwitting element of it. And for my generation, who sort of arrived here on planet Earth being reared by a bunch of baby boomers who actually wittingly rejected reality. They wittingly stepped into the world of sex, drugs, and rock and roll and created their own space where they didn't have to take up the challenge of defending their nation. My generation was raised by that group of people and implicitly was sort of, it was never really demonstrated to us exactly the sort of moral fiber that was required for existence, for defending a nation, what it took to actually have a real standard of living. And whether we knew what we were doing or not, we've actually rebelled from that culture and have really created many of the predominating things in my generation's culture and the generation below me. What's popular is really creating your own reality with the MySpace, the Facebook, just having a certain, just basically assuming that if you don't do something politically, or if you don't contribute to the development of an idea that mankind has been struggling with for centuries, it doesn't really matter. It's okay. Nothing will change. That you're not really holding the reins, basically. And it's a sort of a shrug of the shoulders. Someone else will do it. And if it doesn't, well, that's just the way it's supposed to be. And it's very dangerous. And in a certain sense, this is what this crowd around Obama sort of count on or capitalize on. And so with MySpace and Facebook and the video games have been deployed, actually have been deployed by the people who own them to guarantee that what is popular, what dominates the culture, is this existential, it doesn't really matter character to it.
When you say this concept, creating your own reality, you're essentially saying people lie and live in fantasy states.
Yeah, absolutely. They're lying to themselves. Yeah, and it's basically choose your own fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are physical repercussions for that. So that's what we've been tasked to do as a youth movement, is to make, and with the website, but also with the field organizing, is just blow that up, just knock it over on its head, and recognize that there are physical, real implications to doing or not to doing something.
Well, I know you've been talking with Mr. LaRouche, the people working on LaRouche Pack TV, about how to do that. How do you get across to someone who's in a fantasy state and seems indifferent and is willing to lie their way out of anything? How do you get across to them that their behavior is dangerous to their future?
Well, you have to start, by assuming that they actually don't, in their heart of hearts, really, they know that this is really, what they're doing is impotent. They know it's a joke. And what we've been able to do thus far, and we plan on doing more, is just sort of demonstrating that these things are operations, and laying out very clearly that what they're engaged in, what they spend hours on in a day, is an operation to recruit them away from reality, and they have a choice. Do you want to continue doing that or not? And there's a fine line between spelling everything out for them and then leaving something to be desired so they can actually figure it out. But we're still, it's a good question, because you have to know in your own mind, you have to be conscious in your own mind about, you know, how you treat the world around you. So it's just sort of a developing process. But what's been interesting, especially with the MySpace and the Facebook thing that's used to dominate, is that these are old ideas of sort of self-regulation, self-conscious regulation with popularity and I have to be in the middle of what's popular, I have to be in the middle of what's happening, so I have to be on these things, which is this goes back to Jeremy Bentham. And so you demonstrate the historical nature of these sorts of operations for people, and which is a challenge in its own, because young people really don't know much about history. So if you bring that alive to them, they see that their life isn't just their experiences, but they belong to a whole process of things. And then you get to begin to sort of crack the ice with these things.
I think also the other point is that you can make it clear to someone that you may not like reality and you may want to ignore it, but reality ultimately is not going to ignore you.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly.
And John, you're one of the masters in my thinking at using irony in writing about economics. It seems as though people who are the so-called economists want to give you a lot of material.
They do. They do. It's a never-ending stream of stupidity for me to draw on, to point out the stupidity of what they're saying. I mean, it's, you know, you get these crazy things that... if you're broke, you know, it's because you have a bad attitude, that we're going to revive the financial system which blew up the world, because if we can just take it back to before the point at which it blew up the world, we'll be back in the money. You know, these people are absolutely insane.
Well, I like one of the ironies that you and I talked about last week, which is that the whole idea, supposedly, of the Geithner plan was to get toxic assets off the books of the banks by having other financial institutions, private equity funds and so on, buy them at subsidized prices from the government, with loans from the government, And then the bank said, well, why can't we get in on this? So here you have a plan to get the toxic assets off the books of banks, and the banks are going to start competing and buying them.
It's surreal. It's surreal. And of course, the thing to keep in mind is that even if they're successful in moving these bad assets from the books of the banks to the books of the government, there still is not enough productivity in our economy to pay the bill. So this thing is collapsing no matter what they do. These are accounting tricks. These are nothing but accounting tricks. It's, you know, they're cooking the books of the system just like they're cooking the books of the banks, and none of this stuff is going to make any difference. There's nothing you can do to save this system. They're in complete denial on this, except for the more devious ones at the higher levels of the empire who understand that this is actually a prescription for blowing out the nation state itself.
Now, John, we do have a question that came in from email. It has to do with a prominent Midwest political official who asked to commend Mr. LaRouche for his courage and willingness to speak out on the truth of the collapse. And then he asked, how can we get the majority of the citizens of the U.S. to understand that the derivatives are a criminal scheme being run by the banksters and gangsters and so on? Can you explain, I don't know if we want to go into a whole explanation of derivatives, but what is it about this? You've actually talked about it, but there's a lure of something for nothing. It seems to me that this is part of the way the banks are pushing it, and the little crumbs that fell off the table convinced everyone else that it was really a good program.
You think of it in terms of a casino, in which you go in and you bet, walk in and you make a small bet, and you get a big payoff. That, you know, this is a way in which you make money by betting on things. That you bet that this financial instrument will rise, this financial instrument will decline. It has nothing to do with the real economy, and you're not even betting on the financial instruments yourselves. You start to bet on the movements of them. Because the size of the derivatives market, which is well over $250 billion, is much larger than the size of all of the markets combined upon which this thing is based.
Now, John, on any given day, when you talk about $250 billion, and this is something that I've had asked of me from people who are supposedly in finance, on any given day, banks don't have to come up with $250 billion to cover $250 billion nominal value in derivatives. But they can't come up with even the small income stream anymore that's necessary to keep the leverage up. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, what we're witnessing, the collapse that we're witnessing, is actually a collapse of the derivatives market, that this system of all of these off-balance sheet bets has blown up, and now everybody is trying to get out and to liquidate. So you see forced selling, which is what drives down the prices of assets. And so, you know, then the government steps in and tries to ameliorate this by buying all these crazy assets. But the amount of money that the government has to put into this is actually a very small percentage of the amount that's actually in play in terms of all of these bets. So the whole thing is a ridiculous game. Now, you know, how do you get people to understand this? Well, I think that a lot of people you'll never get to understand this because they're hiding from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that in a collapse period like this, you get two reactions. One is you get the reaction of the sheep who say, uh-oh, this is looking bad. I'd better migrate right into the center of the herd so nothing can get me. And then you'll have other people who stand up on their hind legs and say, this is ridiculous. You know, we're being herded into the slaughterhouse and I'm not going. And those are the people we're looking for. Because, you know, you'll never convince the sheep to be anything other than sheep. But we're not all sheep. And then if you have people who stand up, then you'll have more people breaking out of the herd and saying, yeah, this is, I'm going to fight. If they see someone leading a fight, you know, and this is the point Mr. LaRouche made today at the meeting that we had, that he basically, at his webcast, declared war on the British Empire. Said, we're going to destroy you. And, you know, that's a pretty gutsy move. And, you know, but that's what we intend to do. And so we're leading the fight. We've declared war. We're moving against them, and we're saying to everybody else, if you don't want to go to the slaughterhouse, join with us. And that's what really separates the men from the sheep, as it were.
Now, I want to ask both of you to respond to this question. We have about a little more than 10 minutes to go in the program. This is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, April 18th, 2009. We're talking with John Hofel and Alicia Cheritani on this question, literally a follow-up to what Lyndon LaRouche launched last weekend, last Saturday, taking President Obama to the woodshed and also taking the American people to the woodshed. Now, Paul mentioned this earlier, and John, you just brought up again how you get, you have people who will stand up and fight. What's the situation with the Congress? A lot of people say, can't we get a congressman? Why doesn't the Congress respond? Don't they realize these are problems? Now, we can eliminate for a moment people like Nancy Pelosi, who are part of the problem, who work with Felix Rohatyn and the Wall Street crowd to continue the looting. But what do you say to people, both John and Alicia, when they say, what about the Congress? What can we do?
Well, I would say that they're gutless, and they're not going to act because the pressure on them comes from above, from the financial interests, from the moneyed interests who fund their campaigns. And that's who they're listening to. And the only way that we're going to get any change out of them is if we start roasting them from below to the point where they're more concerned with what their constituents are saying than they are about what the financiers are saying. Or if we organize, we replace them the next time any of these guys are up for re-election, out they go. And we replace them with somebody who has a commitment to saving the nation.
And Alicia, do you have some thoughts on how we can do that?
Well, I would just say on the Congress, I would say this, that it's now that we're looking at the absolute breakdown of an entire system, it's not just a financial system. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of identifying yourself. And I think that the Congress and the baby boomers in that Congress typify that failed system. Is it their, what they identify with, what their, how far they're willing to go out on a limb? It's a failure. People have to begin to look. This isn't just an economic crisis. Yes, it is, and it's a very serious one. But it's also a real moral failure in the political leadership of the United States Congress. And if people, instead of just getting angry at the Congress, if people are serious about a recovery, then it's not who's going to have. Let's figure out who has the best recovery plan. We already have one. LaRouche's authored it in 2007, and we've been organizing it for 2 years now. What we need is the actual, a certain revolution in real conscious morality about what you're willing to fight for, and that the HBPA, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, actually is it's not just a piece of legislation. It's sort of an icon for what, a standard for a citizen to fight for. And if we are going to recover from this at all, people should look at an economic recovery, but also a recovery from this culture of indifference, this existentialist culture. And you'll learn how to do that if you organize for the HBPA.
Yeah. Now, John, let's come back to Larry Summers for a moment, because he's sort of the lead duck. He's actually pretty vulnerable right now because he's been taking, after Lyndon LaRouche said, we've got to get Summers out of there, it seems to have emboldened some others who came out and identified the fact that he was a bit of a kleptomaniac with D.E. Shaw. He pocketed $5 million for almost no work. There are other stories coming out about him. How vulnerable is he? And if he's knocked out, what will that do to the team inside the Obama administration that are controlling the president right now?
Well, I think that, the paradox is he seems to be in complete control. And yet he is quite vulnerable, because one of the biggest problems he has is that he's the guy who's leading Obama into all of these bad policies. He's probably, kissing up to him and all of that, and praising him and playing on his ego and all of this. But as Obama's ratings fall, then Obama with his I'm the one complex, the Nero Narcissus complex, is not going to take the blame himself. He's going to blame his advisors. And who's the first advisor who's going to get blamed? Larry Summers. So Summers could find himself thrown out, I think, rather quickly as the situation deteriorates, as it will. And then when that happens, then the geometry shifts, because Summers is running a protection operation for all of these behavioralist kooks. And so if he's thrown out and anybody competent that comes in, is the first thing they're going to do is they're going to say, all right, you idiots are gone.
Now, John, one other question that came to me, I was asked to bring this up with you. Obama seemed to be accepting the proposal that was presented at the G20 meeting to move toward the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, special drawing rights, the so-called paper gold or funny money, to replace the dollar as a reserve currency. There's been pressure put on the Chinese. There are obviously British operations running into Russia and so on to try and convince the Russians to go for this. How far down the road are we toward the SDR replacing the dollar as the reserve currency? And is there a potential to resist this in the United States?
Well, I think there is. The question of how long it takes for the SDR to replace the dollar depends upon how long it takes for hyperinflation to break out so much into the open that the value of the dollar just evaporates. Because you've got the Brits are playing a very typically duplicitous game here. On the one hand, they're telling the United States, you have to do this bailout. You have to bail these banks out. You have
pump,
to bail
pump
these.
More dollars into the system.
Yeah, pump more dollars all the time. Pump, pump, pump. And then at the same time, they're running around to the rest of the world saying, the American money pumping is going to blow out the dollar, and so therefore, we have to band together to protect ourselves. And the way to protect ourselves is through the IMF. So the British are setting this trap, one, for the United States to blow itself up, and two, for all of the other nations to walk, you know, step into my parlor, said the spider to the fly, to walk into the trap, which is the IMF, which is actually, you know, the web of the spider itself, the British Empire. So this whole thing is being played as a typical British double game in which, you know, they're playing both sides against the middle.
Well, John, here's a question that should be obvious, but with that kind of game being played while Obama was sitting there at the G20 meeting, and he should have seen it around him, how is it that he's not hearing the same people who are whispering in his ear, you're doing a great job, keep the money pumping going, we need more stimulus? How does he not then turn around and see them say to other countries, the U.S. is going to wreck the dollar and bring you down with it?
Well, I think that, you know, this is where his Nero complex comes in. He's more concerned at this point, from everything I can tell, with himself.
Mm-hmm.
He's very self-absorbed. And these other things, he can deal with all of this. That I think his view is that we have to save this financial system, and then when we do this, then I'm going to lead the way to fix all of this and straighten it all out and lead the world into this bright green new future.
And Alicia, we have very little time left, but it does appear as though what Obama is doing is staking everything on the idea that there's a lot of money to be made in solar power and windmills. Is that the reading that you have?
Yeah. Again, I think it's the same people whispering in his ear, because as LaRouche and John Hopeful have made very clear, that's just part of the same austerity package. And it's just the hot air for the windmills, that's all. He doesn't really know what he's talking about.
Well, and Lynn, also, I should add, the second half of his webcast, he went through very meticulously a discussion of energy, why we need to go nuclear, why we need to invest in new technologies of high energy flux density, and why, in fact, the global warming crowd, the solar and wind energy crowd, really are nothing but genocidalists. John, do you have a final comment on that?
Well, I think you just summed it up. They're genocidalists. This is not an energy policy. This is a political policy. This is about downsizing, how you sell the downsizing of humanity as a positive. And this is the way that they're doing it.
Well, I think we've had a very good opening shot from what Lynn did last Saturday and what the two of you have done today to get people to understand that they're drinking the old snake oil, the old flim-flam. That's what we're seeing with Larry Summers, Thaler, Sunstein, and this whole crowd of behavioral economists. If you fall for it, and I'm talking now to the American people, You're going to get what you deserve. And the way not to fall for it is go to our website, go to LaRouchePack.com, start shaking up your friends, get people thinking, get people to listen to what Lyndon LaRouche said last Saturday. And by the way, we have another webcast coming up on April 28th. That'll be 1 p.m. Eastern time. It's a little bit ahead, so it gives you time to plan for it. But another webcast. And until next week, this has been the LaRouche Show. John and Alicia, thank you very much for being with us today.